My name is Ed Goldberg. Welcome to Author Author, an occasional series of conversations with authors touring through Portland or whom I have reached by phone. My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Molly Antipol. Molly, welcome to All Classical Portland.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. Title of your book is The Un-Americans. We can talk about that. It's, I seldom ask writers, why did that title? But we might talk about that.
Okay.
And your book is published by Norton. Now, before I actually get into the meat of the book, this is a book of short stories, and it's been very well received. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I've written 5 novels, and I kind of understand how you structure a novel, how you pace a novel, the story arcs in a novel. I've never been able to understand the structure and function of a short story. Do you have theories about that or practical applications for that?
You know, I've spent so much time thinking about it. You know, the book in total took me 10 years, and so I think in that time I was just really trying to teach myself how to write a short story. And I think that for a long time, I was trying very hard to write these kind of short, spare, single-scene stories, even though they went against what came naturally to me because it was just what I was reading. Those were my models. And I think once I realized that I wanted to write these long, expansive stories where I was able to throw everything, like every bit of myself and every bit of research into each story, once I realized that that was possible to do in a story, I started to figure out structure. So for me, that was just finding the right writers as models. So Alice Munro was really big for me, Edward P. Jones, Deborah Eisenberg, just these kind of long, almost novelistic short story writers.
Mm-hmm. What do you try to achieve in a short story? One of my pet peeves is what I call the New Yorker short story, which is all middle with no beginning and no end. You know, and somebody's staring out at the Hudson River through the windows, you know, and that's the way it ends.
Also. Right, and realizing how meaningless they are and how small they are in the world, right?
And you can't go to a good bagel anymore, right? Yeah. What do you want to achieve in a short story?
I mean, a lot of things. I'm a lover of plot and I'm a lover of action. And that was one of the more challenging but also ultimately pleasurable things about writing this book was figuring out how to really have things happen in my stories while still being, you know, character and psychologically based. And I think that more than anything, what I'm trying to achieve in these stories is just to try to see the world through other people's eyes and to have empathy for all the different people in my book. So, you know, I was writing from the perspective of men and women, younger, older, you know, American, Israeli, European. And with all of them, I was just like, okay, I really want to care about all of these people and to have a lot of compassion for them. And it was sort of an exercise in empathy in the end.
One of the themes I got out of this book anyway is tyranny. That some of your stories deal with tyranny. In fact, quite a few of them mm-hmm. do. And I'm talking about tyranny of all kinds, just not just political or social, but also personal mm-hmm. tyranny, even multi-generational personal tyranny with the story of, I guess it's called, the one about Eva Kaplan.
Oh, right, Retrospectives.
Retrospectives, thank you. That didn't pop into my head right away. You set your books in places like the United States, what used to be the Soviet Union, and the United States in the 50s, and in Israel, Tel Aviv, for example. And each of these places, both time-wise and action-wise, has had experience of extreme grief and conflict. Is it good to set a story in a place like that because certain things are expected from your setting, or is it because you have personal experience in places like that?
You know, it was actually something that I hadn't planned at all. I think that I'm just kind of a big research nerd. Like, I just love spending time in the archives. I've just always been so fascinated by a lot of these historical times and these places. And so those were the nonfiction books I was reading, and those were the documentaries I was watching even before I started writing. So that just kind of came naturally. You know, the stories always start with just a voice or an image, and then I just keep thinking, okay, well, where do they live, and what's getting at them, and what are they resisting? And once I start to flesh out their world, I figure out where they are. But I had never thought about setting my stories in any of these places. And in fact, I was kind of concerned, like, halfway into the book, like, wow, these stories are not linked together by voice or by setting or so many of the things that I had looked to other story collections as models. And I actually wondered, like, okay, how is this all going to work? And so the fact that you talked about the tyrannical thread that weaves throughout the book is a really cool way to think about it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Thanks. Well, let's start with the story entitled The Old World. I think it's the first story in the book. And it's about Sveta, who was an immigrant into the United States from Ukraine, and Howard. And he marries Sveta under, unusual circumstances. You want to talk a little bit about that?
About the story?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was an interesting story for me to write. The protagonist, Howard, he's recently divorced and he's really close to his daughter. And he's sort of relishing in the fact that he and his daughter are both kind of in these sort of lost, up in the air places in their lives. His daughter is trying to figure out what she wants to do career-wise. Howard is alone for the first time. And I think that he's found a somewhat clingy relationship to his daughter. And so then his daughter deals with her sense of feelings of being lost by discovering orthodoxy and becomes kind of a born-again Jew. And so I think that just brings up so much for Howard that he ends up seeking out and getting involved in a relationship with a recently widowed Ukrainian woman that is just, the reader, as I was writing the story, I thought, wow, this is all wrong, but what is it like for these two lost people, for Howard and Sveta, to want something so deeply and to be searching so intensely for a connection, even if, as the readers, we can see around their situation and can tell it won't work out?
Wow, I knew that, but I was kind of hoping against hope that something would happen, because there's a story later in the book where something happens hoping against hope, and where Golly, the young daughter, brings a couple of people together. We'll talk about that in a bit.
Oh, yeah.
There's a line in the story that I really liked. It's just another poor family with too much faith in God. Oh, yeah, that resonated with me. That's you seem wise beyond your years for something like that. Have you seen that in real life?
Yes, I have. Yeah, I definitely see I see myself in all of these stories and in all of these characters.
Mm-hmm. So you're actually working out things. I always said that writing is the cheapest form of psychotherapy. Yes. So you're kind of working things out for yourself with this?
Yeah. It's funny because my book's only been out for a couple of weeks, but I've had, people write to me and say, wow, these stories seem so unlike you, Molly. And, they seem so far from your experience. And it's true that, there are no stories about youngish female writers, teaching creative writing and living in San Francisco. But I feel like they're all so autobiographical in the sense that they're capturing whatever I was obsessed with and kind of questioning during that time. So I think so many of the just sort of like the psychological and relationship things that I was wrestling with during the decade that I was writing the stories very much made their way into the book.
Mm-hmm. Now, Howard at the end comes to a crisis, which I'm not going to go into details, but I kept wondering at the end, is he resigned to the situation or has he surrendered to it? And is there a difference?
There is a difference. It's a subtle one, but I think it's a heartbreaking one because... Yeah, I think that it's this moment of seeing the one thing that everyone else had always been able to see, and he's just seeing it for the first time. And I think it is more of a surrender than a resignation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, are people more affected by things they can't control or their inability to cope with situations?
In life or in my book?
In life. I mean, because it informs what's in your book.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Case by case basis.
I think in my life, I have a harder time accepting the ways that I've messed up when I could have controlled it. And the things that are out of my control, I say, okay, well, that was out of my control and I can kind of move on. And that just might be a like putting pressure on myself thing. And I do think that a lot of my characters are that way too. They just, a lot of times they're just filled with this regret for things that they wish they had done differently in earlier parts of their lives. But there's a sense that they can't escape certain historical or political shadows, and they seem to accept that in a way.
Mm-hmm. Well, no lesson ever comes cheap. There's no doubt about that. No real lesson.
True.
Yeah. I'll talk about a book entitled Minor Heroics. This is Irony on the Moshav is the way I thought about this book. Moshav is a settlement in Israel, different from a kibbutz because things are not owned in common. I mean, there's a whole bunch of different reasons for it. But the irony is deep because there are two sons. One is a war hero and one, let's say, isn't. But the war hero gets caught in a situation where he has to be rescued by his kid brother, and the heroic thing kind of shifts a little bit, doesn't it? Can you talk a little bit about the story?
Yeah. So in this story, it's about two brothers. One, as you know, yes, he's a war hero. He had... He'd been a decorated soldier, and his name is Asaf, and he had just been discharged, and he's kind of perfect and godly in many ways. He has this girlfriend that the younger character, Oren, who's the narrator, just really, really adores, and the narrator, who's the younger brother, Oren, has just been living under his brother's shadow his entire life. And he's just sort of filled with that sense of pain and resentment. And, you know, in Israel, a place where it really matters, you know, what you're doing in the army, and it has so much, you know, it's you know, his brother has been decorated and just kind of walks around with this air of prestige. And Oren did really horribly in his army placements and is a driver, which is like a pretty low rung position in the IDF. But one day, his older brother, Asaf, suffers a freak accident on the Moshav, and he's really injured by a tractor. And suddenly, Oren's job as a driver, where he knows every side street and every alley in Israel, suddenly that comes into play. And Oren essentially saves his life because of his driving skills. And so I was really interested in the dynamic between those two people and also the shifts in family that occur because of that. And just the way that the word hero is kind of thrown around throughout the story, but what it ultimately means for this family to kind of have that dynamic be shifted.
Yeah, heroics come in all kinds of forms.
Mm-hmm.
And the old cliche about having greatness thrust upon you is really true, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it just happens. That's a good story, by the way, and I like it because of not just the relationship between the two brothers, but the relationship that Oren begins to have with his brother's girlfriend, mm-hmm. fiance. I forget what her status is at the moment. And he's really dancing on thin ice because he knows he's doing something dangerous, and yet he's compelled, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that happens to all of us at some point. She's nodding her head. This is a good thing to do on radio.
On radio, it's a really good thing to nod my head. I mean, well, what I was thinking about that, it's funny that, I mean, every one of these stories took at least 10 drafts. And in an earlier...
Really?
Oh, yeah. And in an earlier version of this story, I had more happen between the younger brother and the girlfriend. But in a later draft, I thought, wow, you know, it would be a lot more psychologically interesting to play with the possibility rather than something actually happening. Because I think that what it does is it lends to more moral ambiguity. And there's something, the thing that really struck me when I was writing this story is that the narrator starts to really relish the fact that his brother had his leg amputated, his entire life has changed, but his brother in some really kind of sick, but I think also very human way, is really enjoying the aftermath of this accident and is enjoying all of the attention and the praise that it's, you know, that's being reaped. And that was really fascinating. And so I thought if I actually kept the stuff with the girlfriend a lot more subtle and it was so much more about the possibility, then I could just kind of really get my hands dirty and delve into the psychology of the two brothers.
Mm-hmm. So like a lot of people, you believe that writing is rewriting.
Oh, I completely believe that writing is rewriting. I mean, I've had other writers tell me, okay, everybody gets that one gift where a story appears in your mind fully formed, and there it is, and all you have to do is transcribe it, and that has never happened to me. Every one of these stories was exhausting and stressful, and I wondered if I would ever be able to see the light at the end of the tunnel, and then when I did, it was rewarding, and then I had to put it in a drawer for 4 months and realize what else was wrong with it. I mean, it's just a process, and every story took me about a year to write.
So getting that story fully formed in your head is not actually writing, it's taking dictation.
I mean, that's what other people say, but I've never had that happen. I mean, I think for me, it's just about like messing up and marking something up and throwing it in a drawer and thinking it's terrible and working on something else.
Yeah.
And it's just like a big, messy, emotional process, but it's so deeply satisfying once the story starts to click.
I'd like to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Molly Antipol. Her name is spelled Antopol. The title of her book is The Un-Americans, and it's published by Norton. Why The Un-Americans? That's kind of, I mean, normally I don't ask writers about their titles, but why that title?
Well, the first stories that I wrote in the book were very much inspired by my family history, notably their involvement in the Communist Party. I come from a big
family. Are you a red diaper baby?
My mother's a red diaper baby.
Uh-huh. Excellent.
Yes, so excellent.
For people who don't know what that is, that's a child born into a dedicated Communist Party family.
Yes.
CPUSA, I have to say that.
So,
yeah.
So with the early stories, I was just really interested. You know, I come from this big family of storytellers, and I had just kind of grown up hearing those stories of the dinnertime visits from the FBI and the tapped lines. And I just, without even realizing it, I just kept kind of moving toward that place in time, really trying to understand it and trying to figure out what it might be like for red diaper babies, you know, for the children of communist and what it's like to kind of inherit that much political heaviness and how that affects your life. So the early stories were the McCarthy era stories, and that's definitely, like, you know, the word on American, that's what it brings, that's obviously what it brought up for me and what it brings up for most people. But as I was writing, I also became really, really interested in what the word un-American might mean to this current generation of Israelis, you know, who have this, you know, America and Israel have this incredibly close and almost symbiotic, but also very messy relationship. And I was really interested in Israelis who are my age, who basically grew up, like basically inherited this relationship to the U.S. And I wanted to explore that in this book. So, you know, for example, in Minor Heroics, which we were just talking about, one of the brothers is forced to defend a settlement filled with American religious families, and he deeply resents it, but he still pines for a chance to visit America for himself.
People have such a funny love-hate relationship with the United States around the world.
Oh, it's amazing. And then also with the Eastern Europe stories, that was, so a third of the book is McCarthy era stories, a third is Israel stories, and a third are set in Eastern Europe. And with the Eastern Europe stories, you know, so many of my characters are banned writers or banned artists or dissidents. I feel like for so many of them, they've spent their whole lives kind of fighting the government and trying to fight communism, only to come over to the U.S. and realize that they're not living under that level of surveillance anymore. Like, they're not even really treated as citizens or looked at as citizens. For so many of my characters, I think that's that feeling of, wow, I've been fighting communism my whole life and fighting the feeling of living under surveillance, only to come to a place where no one's even noticing me. And so I was really interested in that. And the feeling of wistfulness that might bring up for some of my characters.
Yeah. The most, I don't want to say the least profound example of what you're saying is somebody who's a physician in the Philippines and comes to this country and can't get a job as a doctor because they don't recognize the degree from the university he went to, and winds up, you know, cleaning toilets in a movie theater.
So. I know. I taught ESL, English as a Second Language, for many years, and those stories just broke my heart every time, like exactly the story that you've told, just over and over. And I feel like for so many of my students who had, you know, who had been surgeons, you know, in their mother countries, only to come here. And, you know, I had one who had been a surgeon back home, and then she came to New York and she was making smoothies at Penn Station and commuting like 2.5 hours to get there. And with every one of my students, when I would ask them, they said, I'm doing it for my children. And that was something that really struck me and felt so poignant. And it was something that also came out a lot in the book, is just that dynamic between immigrant parents and their children, and the children are trying so hard to please their parents, but they're also inheriting so much heaviness and so much weight because of all the things that are expected mm-hmm. expected of them now.
Well, there's a certain amount of guilt that has to exist in the world,
and and I hold a lot of it, but not all of it.
This continues to feed into it. So
right,
the story. My grandmother tells me this story. It moved me for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's about teenage partisans in Belarus fighting the Nazis, okay? And then it moves to this country, and Leon and Raya are the two characters. Leon was a teenage partisan leader, and Raya escaped through the sewers and into the forest, where she was rescued by Leon and his group of partisans. And this is all based in truth. This really happened, and you had 17-year-old kids fighting the Nazis as partisans, as guerrillas. And then something comes out about Raya's story later in the story, which I'm not going to get into in detail, but it led me to believe that, okay, here's the question. Do people do what they need to do to survive, or does existing in a world of evil just create more evil?
I think both. And that was something I was really... That was by far the hardest story for me to write, because it was such a morally fraught subject, and yet I didn't want to do any moralizing as a writer. And so I really needed to have it play out completely in scene and with my characters. Yeah, and there's this moment in the end of the story where she essentially, you know, this young partisan girl essentially robs a small family of very innocent peasants, and I'm sensing probably, I mean, I'm sure that they didn't make it through the winter, because she steals everything that she can. And I felt with that story that if I could just stay so closely within the point of view of one person and try so hard to understand the psychology of what this experience might do to a person who I saw in the beginning of the story is essentially good, as this good girl, but then she's put in this situation, and what would that do to her? I just really wanted to explore that. And I also wanted to explore, the story partly takes place, in World War II era Belarus, but it also jumps ahead to the present day, and she's having this, this conversation, this very tense and fraught conversation with her granddaughter, who's just asking her so many questions about the stuff she doesn't want to talk about. And that was really interesting to me, too, to think about the way that guilt and shame will just reverberate throughout an entire lifetime and kind of what that does to the way someone lives with themselves and lives with the world.
Is Raya really guilty? Is she really ashamed of what she did?
I don't know. I think that I try so hard. I feel like my job is to really love my characters but never to judge them. Mm-hmm. And so my sense with her is that she
did what she had to do.
Is that she did what she had to do, but she also knows that she did a little bit more, that she took more than she needed because she was falling apart and because her entire life had fallen apart. And she can look back now and say, I didn't need to take everything. I didn't need to ruin these people's lives. But she also, I think, through those generations of reflection, is able to see that she wasn't totally in the wrong. And that's what felt so interesting to me, was to see all the different sides of it.
I'd like to talk to you about a story entitled The Unknown Soldier. And I've had for decades now an abiding interest in the whole McCarthy era, HUAC, Red Scare, going back to the original Red Scare in 1917, with the Palmer raids, mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff. And even going back to the Haymarket riots and things like that. And this story encapsulates a lot of what that's about. And I noticed in your author's page that you talked about two books that are very important. One especially, which is Victor Novasky's Naming mm-hmm. Names, which is a sordid history of the House Un-American Activities Committee, where the term un-American really belongs.
Right.
Yeah. In this story, why don't you tell us, there's a man named Alexei, and what's going on in Alexei's life?
This was an interesting story. I am also very fascinated by the Red Scare and by that entire era. And something I kept thinking about is, what would happen if someone were black, if someone basically kind of fabricated a background and a set of political beliefs to make his way into Hollywood and into this, sort of liberal Jewish club in Hollywood, only then to be blacklisted for these fabricated politics. And so that was so interesting to me, and to think about how that would affect his family, like this idea of doing something in a purely opportunistic fashion, to not really care about these politics. My narrator, his name's Alexei Liebman, and he, he's an out-of-work actor who is not getting parts and is not doing well. And he realizes at a certain moment, wait, what if I play up my Russian background? What if I elaborate on the few stories that I've heard from my parents? When Alexei had moved to the U.S. from Russia when he was still a baby, and he actually doesn't remember anything about Russia, but suddenly he's pulling out these stories from his parents and embellishing them and trying to create like a completely false persona to appeal to people in Hollywood. And suddenly he finds himself at party meetings and and joining the party and getting really political. And it's completely it's completely pure, completely driven by ambition and the fact that he wants to be successful. And then what happens is he becomes blacklisted before his movie's even released. And he's essentially, thrown into obscurity before the world even has a chance to know that he exists.
Not to mention being thrown into jail for contempt of Congress.
And his wife, who never knew about this and wasn't political herself, her life is essentially ruined. And his son is really, his life is ruined. I mean, his father's gone. And so I was just really interested. I think that for so many of my characters, their whole lives are these political beliefs, and they put everything into their politics. And so I was really interested in thinking about the other side. Like, what if someone really doesn't care and they're doing it for a totally different reason, and how are they affected by it?
Well, I don't want to give anything away here, but I do have to say that the emotional climax of the story, the end of the story, is very satisfying to me. So thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad.
It could have ended so badly,
I'm glad you said that.
Yeah. Okay. Good. I read that I think it's just in this book that you're working on a novel now.
I am.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about it? Are you superstitious?
I'm slightly superstitious, but it's called The After Party, and it's set in Israel, Eastern Europe, and New York, right after the fall of communism.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the wall comes down, and then what, huh?
And then what? And yeah. how? What are the reverberations kind of all throughout the world?
My interest in the Red Scare and the McCarthy era was just out of outrage. I was not involved in it personally or anything like that. But I think if people really knew about it, I mean, people complain now about the polarized political situation in this country and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But if they really knew what it was like to live in a Kafkaesque world where merely the accusation was enough to destroy your life, never mind proving it, never mind going to a court of law, merely the accusation. I mean, that's a Kafkaesque universe. And maybe we need Franz Kafka back to write about it. But have you ever thought of doing a novel strictly about that?
About surveillance?
About the what it's like to live in that kind of a, almost like a police state.
I certainly think about it a lot. I think it's come out in a couple of the stories. In Duck and Cover, I was really interested in what it's like for this child of a communist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we used to do duck and cover drills in school. I'm that old.
Mm-hmm. You look very young.
Oh, thank you so much. My first example of black humor was we had a little sign in the wall that told you what to do in the event of an atomic blast. You know, get under your desk, put your head between your knees, and then somebody will run underneath it and kiss your ass goodbye.
That's hilarious.
It really is. I just thought that was the funniest thing I ever read. The other great remark to come out of contempt of Congress is, I don't remember who said it, was, you can't put me away long enough to match the contempt I have for this Congress.
That's wow.
Yeah,
wow.
I know. Feel free to steal it. I did. It's been great talking to you.
Oh,
I
hope it's been so good talking to you.
I hope you come back with your novel when it's out. I've been speaking with Molly Antipol. The title of her book is The Un-Americans, and it's published by Norton. Again, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for this.
You've been listening to Author, Author, produced at the studios of All Classical KQAC-FM in Portland. My name is Ed Goldberg. You can find these programs at our website, allclassical.org/author. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back soon.